In this lecture, we're going to talk about Nietzsche's various literary styles and the implications these have for his quest for truth, or in general, the quest for truth. Nietzsche was an experimentalist with regard to style, and this makes interpreting him a very difficult matter. For example, I've already talked to a great extent about Zarathustra as a character, but I haven't mentioned the fact that other characters sometimes appear in the book about Zarathustra, sometimes as kind of walk-on parts that are never seen again. One I'll mention, because it's of particular interest, is a character called the Ugliest Man. Zarathustra encounters a pretty miserable character who really doesn't want to be seen at all, known as the Ugliest Man, and eventually gets the Ugliest Man to confess that he actually is the killer of God. Hard to know what to make of that, especially when you reflect on the fact that, after all, Socrates is well known for being ugly. Is Socrates the ugliest man? One might say that Socrates' tradition, in a way, doesn't ally as easily as many people have thought with the Christian tradition. After all, Socrates encourages rational investigation, and that, as Nietzsche sees it, is exactly one of the things that has led to the demise of faith in the Christian God. On the other hand, one of the comments the ugliest man, the character, makes is that he couldn't stand it anymore. God was watching him constantly, and being ugly, it was just something that became intolerable. Hence his motivation. That sounds sort of playful, but again, this resonates with the way Nietzsche thinks the death of God has actually come about. More and more, in his opinion, people came to see themselves as fundamentally flawed, fundamentally ugly, fundamentally sinful, and pushing that to its extreme point, it becomes intolerable to imagine a divine being viewing all of that, hence the death of God. A lot of these rather playful images actually do tell stories or make points that Nietzsche wants to assert, but he doesn't present them as simple assertions, simple statements of the facts of the matter. Instead, they're provocative. In general, I would say one of his general tendencies, or basically what he's trying to do, is give us an experience of thought, not so much the general idea that he concluded. Many philosophers make arguments defending a certain point, and there's no effort to explain how it is they came to the conclusion. In fact, truth be told, as Nietzsche sees it, oftentimes philosophers come to their conclusions before constructing the arguments, and then only after the fact manufacture arguments that might lead to this conclusion. In a sense, Nietzsche does the opposite. He starts forays of thought that allow the reader to come to conclusions themselves. Sometimes he pursues them for only a paragraph or a few sentences, sometimes for several pages, and in the aphoristic works at least, oftentimes after pursuing a line of thought, he drops it. Maybe he'll pick it up again in a later passage, maybe not. Maybe what he pursues after that seems to be a thought in a very different direction. And again, I think what he's trying to do is demonstrate something like the process of thinking, that when one has a kind of insight or intuition, one does pursue a certain train of thought for a way, but then put it down sometimes, maybe never to return to it. Another aspect of the process of thinking that Nietzsche's concerned with is something that he categorizes as musical. He prides himself on exploring different kinds of tempo or tempi in writing, much as a musician might do in music. So he suggests that he's arranged many of his books with a kind of sense of pace in mind. Sometimes he'll have a rather plodding pace, attempting to reach a conclusion only very slowly, but methodically. Other times he allows a kind of gallop to happen, so that one is almost breathless by the end of one of his running passages. Again, there's a kind of sense that this is much the way people actually do think. And he isn't so concerned that we draw exactly the conclusions he does as that we share the experience with him to a certain point. One of the particular stylistic features that we've talked a bit about, but I'd like to go into a bit further here, is his use of the aphorism. What are called aphorisms in Nietzsche's works, as we've mentioned, sometimes extend for several pages, but the quintessential aphorism is essentially a simple line. And Nietzsche has a lot to say about his reliance on the aphorism. He describes it as something like stepping from mountaintop to mountaintop. And he makes it very clear that he doesn't think the reader is going to get the whole story simply by reading the aphorism. What the aphorism has to do with is Nietzsche's desire for an active readership. not people who passively go along with what he says and simply draw the same conclusions that he does, but instead fellow companions in thought who engage the same kind of train of thought to an extent, but then are free to pursue it any way they like. Indeed, Nietzsche wants companions in this respect, not simple followers. I'm going to take an example of one of Nietzsche's aphorisms and suggest the many ways in which one might continue the line of thought, just to point out how variably one might take it. And this is probably one of his most famous aphorisms, actually even heard in such popular culture venues as Conan the Barbarian, the particular line being, "What doesn't kill me makes me stronger." Actually, this line, although quoted oftentimes out of context without attribution, is not simply that line as quoted, but it has a preface, as Nietzsche states it. The preface is, "Out of life's school of war." Out of life's school of war, what doesn't kill me makes me stronger. I think with the preface, we're given certain suggestions as to how we might take it, but very, very different directions might emerge. For example, you might see this as a suggestion that life is rough. It is a bit like a school of war. And in a sense, what doesn't kill me makes me stronger. You almost have to think that if you're going to get through it alive. On the other hand, maybe it's simply the reversal that Nietzsche's getting at. Out of life's school of war, what doesn't kill me makes me stronger. Well, in a certain straightforward way, thinking about military thought, there is a sense in which defeats actually do take a toll. What doesn't kill you might, in fact, make you a lot more vulnerable toward the future. So we get a reversal of what's expected here. What could that possibly mean? Well, perhaps another way of looking at it is to say, what doesn't kill me makes me stronger in that I've learned from experience. In military thinking or in any kind of strategic thinking in life, having certain kinds of experiences makes you more prepared for what you might come across in the future, even though it probably won't be identical. So you're stronger in that you're more prepared, you're readied. But what are you ready for? Perhaps this is just a kind of whistling in the dark of someone who realizes that they might be risking their life in this case. What doesn't kill me makes me stronger in the sense that I'm not going to let it get me down. Then there's a psychological impact, and this, I think, makes particularly good sense if you think about this in the context of an actual war. What doesn't kill me makes me stronger. Suppose I haven't been killed despite all kinds of situations that might have threatened me. In that case, what's the enemy going to think? It's going to be a lot like a team playing a team that's undefeated for the season. They haven't been killed yet. What makes me, the opponent team, think I can do anything? We get the impression that it's a psychological advantage to have been through a lot and still manage to face battle in the future. This is a great psychological advantage by comparison to someone who perhaps is untested. It's always terrifying to face as an opponent someone who's thought very highly of, who's viewed as strong. Or perhaps what Nietzsche's getting at is we end up developing a kind of suit of armor by virtue of our experiences. We become hardened in a sense. We aren't the vulnerable individual that we start out being, but instead, through life's school of war, we've learned to, in effect, become our own armor or make a kind of armor out of our skin. That makes us less sensitive, but on the other hand, we're certainly stronger. I point to all these possible ways of reading the line in order to draw attention to the fact that Nietzsche doesn't tell us which, if any of them, he has in mind himself. He simply drops this as a line for our further thinking. And in general, I think many of his stylistic experiments attempt to do the same. One of his strategies that often occurs in the aphoristic works is that he juxtaposes things. In Daybreak or Dawn, for instance, he has a series of passages that open the work that talk a lot about custom, how certain habits for societies simply become customary after a point. And when he talks about this, you get the impression that he's perhaps going to launch a kind of anthropological investigation. Suddenly, he, in a sense, shifts topics by talking about morality. And it seems that he's sort of opened up a totally new line of thought. I think subtly what he's trying to suggest is this really isn't a totally new line of thought. that if you think about customs and habits and then think about morality, are they really entirely different things? He would say that our moralities are really entrenched customs, customs that our societies take to be particularly important, perhaps, but really exactly the same thing, having the same status, certain ways of being that people have found useful or merely traditional and stuck by and felt to be important, really for no fundamentally other reason than the fact that others have done it before them. Frequently, I think what he's trying to do is allow these kind of connections to emerge in our own minds. So while he does want active readership that is going to move forward in thought and take things further, and indeed he often says he doesn't necessarily want to be followed, but nevertheless read and grappled with, still he does sometimes manipulate. So it would be rather surprising if, after all this discussion of habit and custom, one didn't end up thinking, isn't he possibly suggesting that this is a habit too? That our mores are really simply traditions, habits, and I think the big point, changeable.
Reading Nietzsche, it becomes obvious that he doesn't follow what now is considered the standard philosophical mode. And Kathy's account of aphoristic thinking in particular makes the why of this very clear. The dominant mode, at least since Descartes, with the rise of science in the West, has been that philosophy is essentially an argument, and in particular it's a kind of deduction. Now there are philosophers who deviate from this. For example, they would say it's partly an inductive argument, an argument based on experience. But nevertheless, this notion of an argument, something that proceeds from evidence or premise to conclusion, methodically, is something which has dominated the Western tradition for the last 300 years. The most famous example here, of course, is Descartes, who quite explicitly modeled his philosophical method on geometry. Perhaps slightly less known, but equally luminary in the early modern philosophy, is the Dutch philosopher Spinoza, who said, in effect, that truth must be expressed in a geometrical, deductive style, and to read Spinoza's view on ethics, which in fact is a very sensitive, personal book, talking about things like fate and feeling and faith. The truth is, you open it up and it looks like a geometry textbook with propositions and theorems and corollaries and QEDs. And even people like Kant, he calls one of the primary chapters in his greatest book a deduction. And some of the Romantics and some of the philosophers of the early 19th century who are clearly not in the strictly Enlightenment camp also refer to what they're doing as deduction. And of course, the English all the way through, notably John Stuart Mill, is first of all a logician. That's what his philosophy is centered on. And contemporary American English philosophy, as we all know, is very centered on formal logical arguments. Not Nietzsche. In fact, one might say that by this criterion, the criterion that philosophy consists of an argument, a kind of deduction, that all of Nietzsche really consists of a sequence of fallacies. That basically it's all a matter of not doing philosophy right. Or, as many people would put it, not doing philosophy at all, but rather doing some sort of literature, some sort of rhetoric, some sort of art form, but not philosophy. We've already discussed in some detail the sense in which Nietzsche, for example, employs ad hominem arguments, in which he attacks the person rather than the thesis or the argument. The purpose behind this is essentially to give us a larger picture. It's not just the argument. It's not just the inference, and it's not just the conclusion, but rather it's the whole package of the philosopher and his or her philosophy, and of course his or her world, the circumstances which give rise to it. And as we've suggested, this is fair turnabout to turn on Nietzsche and say Nietzsche has to be considered, not just in terms of his ideas and his conclusions, but also in terms of his life, and in particular his incredible solitude, his continuous illness, the brevity of his life, It's an ad hominem argument, but Nietzsche would say it's only such ad hominem arguments which allow us to get the full picture of what's going on in philosophy. And so, too, we suggested that Nietzsche, contrary to the reigning philosophical style, going back to Socrates in this case, Nietzsche often appeals to emotion, and he makes no bones about it. He makes it very clear, as did Kierkegaard before him, that what he's doing is trying to stimulate what Kathy referred to as our experience, and in particular our emotional experience, to make us disgusted, often with ourselves, to make us curious about the world, to make us see beauty where perhaps we didn't see it before. And in Kierkegaard's case, of course, it's to prod us into faith where before we had perhaps been too timid to try it. But appeals to emotion for Nietzsche and for Kierkegaard are the absolute essence of philosophy. And one might say that for Nietzsche, trying to prod us into these emotional experiences, philosophy becomes, in the dichotomy that's been around since Plato, a matter of rhetoric, not a matter of logic and argument. Now, I mentioned in a previous lecture that Socrates, although he himself distinguished his work from those of his rivals, the Sophists, and Plato certainly makes this very clear, I suggested that, in fact, Socrates really is one of the Sophists. In fact, he's one of the best of them. The truth is that sophistry, as we now use that term, isn't just a matter of argument, but it's also appeal to emotion. And it is, to put it in terms that Nietzsche would certainly approve, an art form. Argument, after all, is an art form. Philosophers, I think, when they use strict logical form, convince no one. Take, for example, some of the famous arguments which prove God's existence, which Kierkegaard makes fun of at great length. I won't go into the details here, but the idea that, for example, if you can have a thought of an infinite being, then it follows through some fairly fancy logical footwork that such a being must exist. I'm willing to bet that there is not a single individual in the history of religion who has ever been converted on the basis of such an argument. St. Anselm, the most famous Christian thinker who invented one version of that complicated argument, in fact, embeds it within a statement of devout faith and makes it very clear the point of the argument is not conversion, convincing the unbeliever, but rather for someone who already believes. This is a kind of rational structure to put on top of the belief. In general, philosophy is not logic. Philosophy is a kind of rhetoric. And of course, Socrates himself was a great rhetorician. Many of his arguments, every classic scholar will agree, many of his arguments are terrible. They really are not even the kind of argument that we would allow in a freshman undergraduate. Nevertheless, they're very powerful, and they're powerful because of Socrates' personality. They're powerful because of the mode of presentation. They're powerful because he knows how to deal with other people. And so too with Nietzsche. One is not doing him a disservice when one says, as a good many of the postmodernists recently have said, that what he's doing is rhetoric, not logic. I think a better way to put it is that what Nietzsche is doing is art, not science. But that's in a way unfair, because Nietzsche often says he's doing science, which raises a very important question. I would put it this way. If what Nietzsche is doing is rhetorical, it's convincing us, appealing to our emotions, then what happens to truth? Because famously, rhetoric allows us to convince people of many matters that are not true. And logic doesn't give us any protection. As I said, a logical argument standing against a powerful emotional appeal usually doesn't stand a chance, only perhaps with a handful of philosophers. So what happens to the truth? One of Nietzsche's answers is that it gets lost away. And we've already seen some of the reasons why he says this. I want to come back to it in the next lecture and talk about Nietzsche's theories of truth in much more detail. But the dominant view that he presents throughout his philosophy looks like this. There is no truth, there are only interpretations. Now, that sounds very much like a rejection of truth altogether. But then one thinks about something Kathy said in the last lecture about Nietzsche and the importance of truthfulness. Nietzsche was a philosopher who prided himself and praised Zarathustra and Jesus and Socrates for their truthfulness, their willingness to speak the truth, even against popular opposition and current tradition. But what sense does it make to talk about truthfulness, to talk about honesty, to talk about forthrightness, if you don't have truth somewhere to go along with it? Well, one way to answer that question, and one way of mixing up the categories that I've just been using, is to say that all Nietzsche clearly sees philosophy as an art form, and his writing is clearly proof of that. It's not antagonistic with science, but rather Nietzsche, like most of the other thinkers at the end of the 19th century, was fascinated by science, took science very seriously, read what I guess these days would be the German equivalent of Scientific American, knew what was going on, and found it fascinating. But science isn't a singular enterprise either. And just as I did with rationality, I think it's important to understand that when Nietzsche and other philosophers talk about science, as when they talk about rationality, they're often referring to different things and consequently have very different attitudes towards them. Now, early in his career, particularly in the aphoristic period of Human All Too Human, Daybreak, and Gay Science, Nietzsche prized science, often referred to his work as scientific, for one reason above all else, and that is because it was experimental. As Kathy said in the last lecture, Nietzsche's style is through and through experimental. He's trying to have different effects. He's trying different ways of having the desired effect. Science is also experimental. It tries things. And one of Nietzsche's greatest phrases of praise says, "I'm willing to admire any hypothesis which allows, let's try it." And of course, this is, as with some of the philosophers of the Enlightenment, Voltaire, for example, a very keen slap in the face against metaphysics and against theology, because after all, there is no evidence that will demonstrate a metaphysical proposition. There is no evidence that will demonstrate the truth of Christianity or any other religion. This is a matter of faith. It's a matter of metaphysics. Perhaps you might say it's a matter of pure reason. But in any case, it's not something that you can experiment with. It's not something you can look for evidence for. And so Nietzsche wants to say, as Hume did before him, let's just dismiss it. Now, there's another way of thinking about this, of course. You can experiment with religious beliefs. But what you're experimenting with, then, is not the evidence for the proof of God's existence or the Trinity or anything of the sort. What you're experimenting with, and William James about the same time was writing this out quite explicitly, what you're experimenting with is the effect of the belief on the believer. And of course, that's very much in line with what Nietzsche wants to say. But the idea of experimenting with ideas, experimenting with philosophical viewpoints, that's something that he thought was very much a kindred point of view between himself and his philosophy, and science. He also saw science as something purely naturalistic. And to say that science is naturalistic is, first of all, to say that it's not supernatural or supernaturalistic. Explanations, accounts, whether they're of the behavior of nature or the behavior of human beings, must be couched in the language of science. And that means we have to look for causes and effects. That means we have to look for explanations on the order of biology or chemistry or physics or psychology. It means that it's not good enough to say God created us this way. And you can't get an adequate account of the human mind or psyche by talking about God-given human faculties, as many philosophers and psychologists before him were prone to do. He also admires science because it's non-dogmatic. Science always leaves itself open. And one of the points that Nietzsche is fond of making, as a great many thinkers today are, if you look back over the history of science and beliefs about the world more generally, the most obvious thing is that most of the beliefs, certainly most of the general theories that people have held about the world, have turned out to be false. the earth is not flat, the earth is not stationary, species are not permanent in nature. Why do we think that our beliefs about science, our current theories, are now true? The arrogance of contemporary popular science. But no scientist, worthy of his or her title, really accepts that. Every scientist knows theories are always tentative. Our so-called knowledge of the world is in place for as long as the evidence holds out and until some anomaly or counterset of evidence outweighs it. So science is undogmatic in a very important sense, the same sense in which Nietzsche wants to insist that philosophy should be undogmatic. It is always open to alternatives. It's open to new possibilities. It is open to the idea of plural truths, something we'll talk about next time. Sometimes, however, Nietzsche opposes science. And it's a fascinating question in itself to trace throughout his various writings how these attitudes shift and change. For example, in his very early work, when he is still a classic scholar, fundamentally, there appears to be a kind of opposition with science from an aesthetic point of view. In other words, one might think of the world in terms of nature, science, cause and effect. But on the other hand, one might think of nature in purely aesthetic terms. Here's an example. Many years ago, I was sitting with a friend who happens to be a rather accomplished poet in a coffee shop in Austin. And there was a flower on the table. It was a moderately fancy coffee shop. And the flower was perking up through the vase. And my friend said, if I remember more or less correctly, that the flower was spreading its petals and reaching up towards the sun, celebrating the beautiful day. I'm an old biologist, and I was remembering back to college and all those lessons I learned about turgor and cell metabolism and tropisms and the like. But I wisely kept my mouth shut because I realized that my explanation of why the flower was stretching its way upward was so much less elegant than his. There's a sense in which the scientific view of the world can be dry. And in some of his latest works, Twilight of the Idols in particular, Nietzsche actually takes apart some of the talk about cause and effect, not just in philosophy, but even in science more generally, asking whether these concepts are really as specific and as valid as philosophers and scientists assume they are. The aesthetic point of view, on the other hand, often invokes images, metaphors, different kinds of ways of seeing, which are distinctively unscientific. And insofar as Nietzsche opposes science and the aesthetic point of view, then it's going to turn out that aesthetics gets the upper hand. But I want to emphasize that this is not usually the case, and often Nietzsche, like a great many contemporary scientists, wants to note the aesthetic value of science itself. There is something beautiful about seeing how the world works. There is something beautiful, elegant, about the right kind of mathematical theory. And one should say that for Nietzsche, the notion of science is much broader than our notion of science today. That what he was referring to, as were all of the prior German philosophers that we've talked about, was Wissenschaft, where I think the more proper way of understanding it might be something like wisdom or discipline. But it's certainly not restricted to the very narrow confines of physical science, which is often the case today. He likes science throughout his career, insofar as science is debunking. He himself, and this is his appeal to Zarathustra and Jesus as well, saw what was important as bucking tradition, sort of popping balloons, exploding old superstitions and traditions. And insofar as science is particularly good at doing that, insofar as science is skeptical, it obviously won Nietzsche's approval. But in his very late works, he also turns against science in a different way. Partly, he says, science is not always undogmatic, but sometimes it becomes dogmatic. At that point, it loses its virtue. And perhaps more important, he asks the ad hominem question, which I haven't raised so far in this discussion, but the ad hominem question about the scientist, him or herself. And this applies, in this Wissenschaft sense, not just to the natural scientist, but to the scholar as well. Why would people spend their lives often passing up many more pleasurable opportunities just to get the truth? And with this, truth itself becomes a serious problem, which we'll pick up in the next lecture.